what I felt and what people like. Yeah. It explained it. At school, I was very happy. I mean, I was, except for one rather xenophobic and somewhat homosexual master, it was then I fell rather early in my career, who plainly didn't like me. But even then, well, it wasn't agonizing, you know, it wasn't persecuted, but it was obviously despised me in some way. Apart from that, I had a perfectly peaceful time because of naturally anxiety to please, I think, on my part. That's the amiable disposition and capacity for adjustments. So that was all right. The only agonizing moments were when I couldn't remember Latin verse, tried to recite in the morning, or did all the badly, or I didn't know, thought I was going to fail. But that's every schoolboy, yes. I wasn't very ambitious. I mean, I didn't want to be below the 8th or 9th and so on. As I told you, I was never top. Now in Oxford, I really had a very good time as an undergraduate. Because I was, the people I knew were gay, agreeable, full of life, affectionate, amusing, and I can't complain. Both my contemporaries at Corpus, none of whom I now remember, or a few of whom I remember, had people like, oh, I don't know, Bernard Spencer, of course, and his poet, Ronald Rees, Stephen Spender, Martin Cooper, all these people I was brought up with, you know, so then dons like Maurice Barra, were all, it was a very, I mean, intellectually stimulating milieu. And I felt, as we speak, in a state of fairly continuous vitality. And that really was extremely nice. And I can't complain. I have no painful memories at all, too few. Women had nothing to me, as I told you, so that was not a possible source of agony. And, you know, they were very few at Oxford. And I opted out of that world very early.
What about intellectual agony, intellectual anxiety?
By which you mean what?
Well, I remember my own 20s at Harvard, for example, as a time of discovering painfully my limits, discovering what I didn't know, discovering that I was not the kind of clever chap I thought I was, against people much more talented than myself, discovering my weaknesses.
I discovered that already, I discovered there's nothing like as good as some people, but we cannot solve it for me. Never not. There's any walnuts, but Brazil.
Brazil. Walnuts.
Oh. Yes. There's no walnuts. No. When I was aware of people being clever than myself, I didn't mind. Mm-hmm. I'm under-ambitious. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm doing it. Mm-hmm. I'm not that. I mean, I've no wish to shine. Mm-hmm. I may have shone in my life, but out of imbalance.
Yes.
Or unrestraint.
Yes.
Or, but not from wasn't planned, so to speak. I wasn't like Noel Coward when he went to stay with Hesley Asquith in the wharf. Not very far from Oxford. And they all talked with great brilliance. You know, the other guests were, but Asquith and his family. He left for the gloom and was asked what was it like. He said, I came to shine, not to be shone upon. Well, I didn't mind being shone upon.
But you...
No, they didn't bother me.
But you did describe...
No, I knew I wasn't very... I didn't think I was very clever.
But you did describe having a hard time writing the Marx book. It was testing. It was demanding.
I went to the polls. Mm-hmm. I mean, all sorts. Mm-hmm. New college first. I think I told you. It was a very gloomy period. It was 2 awful months. Mm-hmm. So I felt it wasn't much like the common room. They were all pompous, dull, disapproving, heavy, tedious, conventional. I couldn't swim at all in those waters. Like treacle. I couldn't move, just discus. Then I went to All Souls, but again, I came to life among a lot of contemporaries. There were many more young men than old men because of constant recruitment below. But then I was conscious. Two things. First of all, I was idle. Secondly, I taught, but still I didn't write anything, and on the whole I wasted my time talking or seeing people. But then I felt there were certain people there, let us say between the ages of 35 and 45, roughly people who'd been about in the First World War. They speak now 1932 onwards, who strongly disapproved of me.
Why?
They thought I was a chatterbox, idle chatterbox, time waster, waste of my own time and above all that of others, but never come to anything, never write anything or write thought philosophy. But on the whole, it struck me as a sort of quick talker, didn't have any solid flesh. It wasn't a pillar of any society. People like the historian Woodward and Sumner and there was a lawyer called Brierley, all very eminent and honorable men. There was Ron Nelson, a man called Cruttwell, who was principal of Harvard, who was not disagreeable himself. There was Rouse, who was nearer to me in age. There was. Who else was there about in those earlier days? Either were fellows or ex-fellows.
But didn't that sense of you as an idle chatterbox tap into a certain image of yourself that you had at times?
Indeed, I felt way into the pool. I realized what happened. It didn't cure me of it. I didn't feel I wanted to please you.
Yes.
And when I managed to write a book on Karl Marx, which was not a terrific book and not very long, the astonishment among these people that I should have generated anything was very great. And I could see, therefore, how I viewed. And then I went to the war. I started with a warden, a thoroughly nice man called Adam, who was like an old farmer. He was, by nature, kindly and courteous. But I could see that he, too, couldn't quite make out what I was about and what I was doing. And I'd been told by others that, really, I wasn't of enough use. I was quite a jolly talker and amusing and all that.
But by the eve of the war, surely that reputation is now
alive. No, it went to the war. Went to the war. Then I thought, what war career would I do that?
Mm-hmm.
When I came back, because I acquired a certain reputation among civil servants and even ministers for doing, at least I don't know, contributing these dispatches that were well thought of, the attitude towards me of these same people totally changed. And for that I despised them, quite genuinely. Quite genuinely.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You've suddenly become an important person.
Well, yeah. I'm part of the section. Yes. All these important people talked about me as if I was right.
Yes.
Then my value gone up. Mm-hmm. Neither for personal nor for academic reasons.
Yes.
That's why I despise them. I didn't find deep times quite pleased to well thought of. But when Sumner was warden, much worshipped by other people, not by me. Rushed the story, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
When he got me back to ourselves, at least allowed me to come back, various intrigues were on foot. But in 1950 I could see. And the reason was I was okay. And the certificate was issued by ambassadors, high civil servants.
Yes.
All of them quite respectful to me, liked me and so on. People like Macmillan, you see,
yes.
Turned up.
Yes.
As I do know what. Young sort of in all circles of people's friends.
Yeah.
And they were quite pleased to meet me and chatted to me and looked at me as a kind of, got it all right. And that made a total difference to the others. That was very bad, and I realized that the values, although they were quite good scholars, were corrupt to some extent.
Yes.
They were not pure-hearted scholars.
Yes. That's interesting. Hmm? Well, what was it that made you a success in the war?
That's impossible to tell. Absolutely impossible to tell. I wasn't successful in 1941. I was in New York, I was either success or failure. I just sat in an office and got on with my colleagues, but I have no achievements to. What made me success no more was being liked by important persons, personally. Keynes would appear and then I had a very good time with him because he thought I was amusing, clever, and an agreeable talk, intelligent. Just the personal meeting, sort of the outside person, outside world, and getting on with it quite happily, partly that, and partly that I was given a task which suited my talents, which is that of journalism. That's what I was. Yes. There's something journalistic about me. I've never been a journalist professionally. Never could be, I think. But to write sort of pieces about people, about situations, comes fairly easily to me. Yes. And I do it with a certain degree of pleasure and amusement. And this communicates itself to the readers.
Yes.
And the fact that I wrote about quite serious issues fairly accurately,
yes,
but in a lively manner,
yes,
pleased these persons. And so it was a task which exactly fitted me.
You did that from 42 in the American, in the embassy in Washington?
Yes.
Until 45? Until 5.
I went to Moscow, you see.
Yes.
Which was nothing other there. That I had a wonderful time, but that's...
That's for later. We'll talk
about
that.
Well, anyway, that's had nothing to do with English.
Yes.
And then came back in January 46. And left again in April 46.
Yes. What was your title at the embassy?
I was the first secretary.
You were first secretary.
Quite normal, on the diplomatic list. Yeah.
Did you write a dispatch every week?
Yeah, I wrote a telegram. Weekly political summary. Mm-hmm. That went by code or cipher every week. And then I wrote...
And who read that?
Longhand pieces too.
Yes.
Who read that? The cabinet? Burton. All British ambassadors to whom to send. Keep them in touch.
Yes.
In America. High civil servants. It had a circulation of, I should think, 100. But not more. Unless the cabinet read it, but to circulate to them.
Yes.
Certainly Churchill, one time as a legend, that I was special, it was I wrote for Churchill, the adorations to him, that I was sort of sent him, said Tartley Andrew, I never knew him. Mm-hmm. But I met him.
After the war.
Well, I met him, I can tell you, physically. I met him because I was sent to the White House to give him a letter, because nobody else could be found. At that moment, it was rather urgent. And he emerged in a dressing gown, and he said, what do you do? And I mumbled something. He said, splendid. Good work. Carry on. Carry on. Carry on. Very good thing. Yes, with all your energy. Carry on. In other words, if there's any process, he liked to encourage it. It's called dire oui à la vie. Anything which was going on was, yes, to be encouraged to go on. Yes, the opposite of stopping things.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, that was his great gift.
Yes.
Pushing things forward, whatever they might be.
Absolutely.
You see, he had no idea of what I was. Then I met him at dinner in London with Oliver Littleton, whom I knew. Then I met him at Hatfield with assistance. Mm-hmm. We spent the night and we didn't talk. Mm-hmm. Finally, I was asked to lunch, mm-hmm, by him. That's that famous story about having Berlin, which was there.
No.
That kid. The whole world knows, but I might as well tell you. That will amuse you and part the material, I suppose. In 1944, February, let's say, having Berlin was in London. Mrs. Churchill said to Winston, Irving Berlin is in London, he's been very generous, I don't know, some war charity, she was head of Russian morally, anything you like. I think we ought to tell him that we're grateful. Winston said, I want you to come to lunch. She said, I didn't mean that. No reason, I didn't mean lunch. I mean, we'll meet him at the Churchill Club, which existed in those days. I don't know what it was. Just pat him on the shoulder. They were very pleased with it. That's all you need to do. No. I wanted to come to lunch. So I want to talk to him about certain things. She had no idea why. Everybody would be like that. I didn't. Big lunch. She did. This bit of the story itself. Small lunch, that meant, well, everybody was delighted. Living with sharing a suite in the Savoy with Sir Alexander Coda. And have three of the moon. What's the vague knew of my existence? I think because probably he, who did not like Halifax, said all these dispatches signed Halifax are not, you know, written by Halifax, they're written by a hack called Berlin in the back room.
Which was true?
It is true. But the point is that, anyhow, I thought he wouldn't have learned my name. Normally, Prime Minister then inquires to what persons in embassies, for some of what drafts. Yes. So someone must have done it for not particularly benevolent reasons, perhaps. Anyway, so he thought I was an expert in America, exquisitely, and I wanted, when he was in town, he thought he might want to talk to me about it. An interesting American matter. I think we may have mentioned to it. I exist, you know. Somehow I came to his notice. Anyhow, having Berlin disinvited, came, partly consisted of Winston Churchill, Mrs. Churchill, Clementine, his daughter Mary, two private secretaries, the real private secretaries, a man called Martin, who's still alive, and Jock, what's his name, Colconville. The chief whip, who was a man called James Stewart, in Parliament. The Duchess of Buccleuch says she was there. That's not absolutely clear. Maybe. Anyhow, that is all it was. Well, he put Irving Berlin next to him, and he said things like, I pieced it together in various accounts, because it's a floating mass of epos, of all the versions. We have 20 versions in circulation, all of which are true, no doubt, in their various ways. And he said to him, chatted to him. There it is. He said to him, do you think Roosevelt will be re-elected this year? Good in 44, you see. To which Irving Berlin said, well, in the past I voted for him myself. This year I'm not so sure. He had this Brooklyn accent. Are you American? Irving Berlin was very extremely surprised. But obviously Winston thought, well, America and England, let the two streams flow together. Didn't say anything. Partly let that pass. And then I don't know, the position didn't sort of go very well. Because Winston had no small talk. He said, what do you think, rather a little bit frustrated, what do you think is the most important thing you've written for the day, in your opinion? Well, what would you do? Take notes. It was very no idea what this could mean. It said, it'll be a white Christmas. Something rather like that. At which point, Winston thought he was brash and mad. Couldn't understand what was happening at all. Fell into a gloomy silence. Sullen silence. Mrs. Churchill said, you know, we ought to be very grateful to the ladies. Been very generous to her. Generous, said I. Don't understand. More silence. I was by this time. I've been sweating in embarrassment. Then, finally, he said, Mr. Berlin, when do you think the European war is going to end? Just for sake of saying something. Irving Berlin said, sir, I shall never forget this moment. I shall tell my children and my children's children that in the spring of 1944, the Prime Minister of Great Britain asked me.
That's rather good.
Well, he said, what do I mean? Yeah. What do you think you'd say? Yeah. Me, what? At this point, I was very cross. I didn't know what was going on. He said, sir, I'm afraid I'm going to go. Got up. Disrupted lunch. Having really left, went back to Corda and said, Mrs. Churchill was wonderful. She was very nice. She was wonderful to talk to. Churchill is named for Winston Churchill, is the greatest man living, I think. I didn't know what it was. I felt we somehow didn't click. He said that to Corda, told me. Then you see, his wife immediately said to him, fool, I mean, wrong man. I told him. He was delighted. And went, told the entire cabinet, the entire thing, that afternoon.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. The whole story. They all giggled, like anything, you see. And then Corda came to New York and told somebody in the embassy, who told me. I learned of it within about 10 days.
Oh, which wonderful.
It was all right for me, because it's rather like having been denied it always. Yes. Denied it ever happened. At least it was denied by mistake.
Yes.
It's rather that Beethoven was also by mistake with some obscure hack, also called Beethoven. And but then finally, as a result of all this, Winston became aware of it. And after the war, when he was in opposition, Bill Deakin, who wrote his books for the war, took me along because he wanted to talk about the first volume of his memoirs, in which he talks about the Russian trials, Soviet trials. Mm-hmm. For some reason, he thought I was the expert, Russian affairs at least. Yes. Bill Deakin was a representative,
yes.
But I wasn't at all.
Yes.
All I knew was what newspapers says. And shredded me. I mean, we had lunch. First he propped up the book on a kind of vase, but then he thought it was rather impolite when you read during lunch. There were three or four other people there. Well, his daughter and his secretary or something. And Bill. But then we chatted, and he said to me, "Who did you work under in Washington?" I said, "Lord Halifax." "Ah," he said, "Edward is a man compounded of charm. In his presence, I melt. But there's something that goes through him like a yellow streak. Grovel. Grovel to the Germans, grovel to the Americans, grovel to the Indians, grovel to everybody." I didn't know what to say. So I said, well, he's probably had rather narrow education in some ways. "You can believe that," he said, "you can believe anything." After that, like the Duke of Wellington, after that, he sang songs and delivered a violent attack on the Astor family. We said there was nothing but the source of total damage and harm to England. Real damn lot.
Really?
Yes.
What were the grounds for his attack?
He didn't really specify, it was just vituperation. Mm-hmm. I didn't really examine him.
But what was the casus belli?
Well, Mrs. Lady Astor was an appeaser. Mm-hmm.
Yes,
pro-Hitler.
Yes, indeed.
All right. At least we said, all right. Lord Astor was a feeble little thing, just a rag of a man, who went along with her. David Astor was a silly leftist, who was no good either. He was told as a sort of feeble leftist. What other Astor? The cousin, other Astors are all. I mean, there were part of English society which went along with the Germans, which people who didn't stand up. There was sort of the wrong part of the Conservative Party. The Observer, which was our newspaper, was an appeasement paper.
Yes.
And the long before,
yes.
The crisis, I mean, Garvey, yes. Was always wanting to make peace with the Germans. So on the whole, they were the enemy.
Yes.
Part of Halifax belonged to the same.
Yes.
Chamberlain, that was all part of that.
Yes.
They were for friends, you see, in Lindbergh.
Right.
Which I can see. That he wouldn't like them. And there was the right wing, there were no leftists except for poor old David. There were the sons who suddenly Winston was even aware of.
Yes.
Michael Astor, Bill Astor, Jake Astor, who I met in my day.
Yes.
But I think they were very young in war.
Yes.
Meant nothing to him. What he meant was Lady Astor and her husband
and
his cousin, that's it.
Yes.
Okay, can you see?
Did he listen to you?
No. Nor did I much say. Well, he did, yes, to this extent. That he said to me that he was convinced that Tukhachevsky and the other marshals were traitors. They were rightly,
traitors.
And rightly executed. Rightly executed.
Isn't that interesting?
Well, you won't either way, one moment. I demurred at this point and said, you know, it's not very likely. Because if they had been, we don't know the facts, of course, had been, there would be German documents in Berlin, which we captured, which we looked at. There's not the faintest scintilla of evidence among them of any contact. Well, I didn't know if it was true, but that's what I'd been told.
Yes.
But we looked at them.
And what did he say to that?
He said, well, you say that, but I trust Benesch. Now, the charges against these people, the charges, were laundered by the NKVD through Prague.
Indeed, through Benesch.
Well, Benesch may have believed it. Oh. Benesch could have believed it. His secret service cooperated. Mm. His pro-Soviet anyway. And this was the 30s, presumably. Well, he may or may not have known what was happening. Well, let's be charitable, assume that he was taken ill.
I always thought it was the dreadful white Russians who got in touch with Heydrich.
Who did what, though? Who told Heydrich about...
Well, who...
Maintained what?
Tukhachevsky had contact with the German army under Weimar.
Well, inevitably, yes. Because they're being trained on.
Yes.
General von Sick, to the
yes. And then in the late 30s, the white Russians, General Skoblin, General Miller, all these frightful people, had contacts with Heydrich, the SS, fabricated some stories about Tukhachevsky, which were then passed to Benesch and passed to Stalin.
Why did they fabricate them? Just as disinformation?
Yes.
Just to make trouble?
Yes.
It's perfectly possible. But I think, no, I think it's probably, must be an NKVD.
Yes.
Operation.
Yes.
And it started as ordered. That sort of thing to happen. I mean.
Yes.
Well.
Oh, it was. It starts with the NKVD. The white Russians are just the couriers of the NKVD.
Good.
It's one of the most disgraceful aspects of the white Russian emigration.
Well, of course, yes. Could well be. Mm-hmm. But the point is that that he trusted Benesch,
yes.
Who assured him, why should he disbelieve him? So he went on believing this. What he put in his novel, volume, I can't remember. I argued about that a bit.
Right.
And denied it, you see?
Right.
But I can't remember what came out in the end, because I never read the volume first meant to read, I think. It's not to that degree of attention.
Mm.
Don't think I came across.
Mm.
I don't know whether he actually put that in.
Yes.
I doubt it. Would have been terribly attacked if
yes.
he had done it.
Yes.
And people would have noticed.
Yes.
No. But that was the only thing.
Yes.
And then in the end he said to me, and now, Mr. Berlin, what kind of honorarium, would you want? So I said, oh, I don't know, nothing at all, great honor, and brilliance. That's very monkeyish of you. He said, oh, no, I can't have that. And I left, and I did get the honorarium. I remember I didn't know what to do with it. I thought I can't send it back, too insulting. I can give it to a charity, but... No, it's all right. There's that my wife for him. I did read his first volume. I wrote a long letter. I remember noticing something I took exception to. He talks about going to Munich in 19... I would say 32. When Hitler was already about
yes.
in the Brown House.
Yes.
Before he became the power. And he wanted to meet Hitler. That was the point to join him. Because, well, he was sort of anti-Russian. It might be all right. I don't think he had any anti-Hitler feelings. By 32, he had no anti-Hitler feelings, I suspect. And he went to Lindemann. And they were entertained by Michael Putzi von Stemmler. He was a son of the famous not art dealers, but art people, the producers, wonderful. Wonderful reproductions of art with Hofstengel in Munich. He was at Harvard, he was polite, he knew some people in America, he was elegant, he was played the piano. For eminent foreigners, he was regarded, he was a go-between. He was a man who was arranged, mm-hmm. was a sort of obvious person to look after well-mannered foreigners. Might want to be a little important kind. Well, they all dined together, and he played the piano, and all these things happened. And then Winston said, I'm according to himself, this is in the volume, beginning, he said, you're the Führer of the party, the leader of the party, Hitler. I can conceive, I rather admire what you did. When a country is down, I admire any man who pulls it up by whatever way you see and gives it pride or whatever it is. And so I've got respect for this sort of achievement of his part. Here he has made a difference. But what's all this about the Jews, he said. Of course, he said, if the Jews are against the country, one has to do something. But the German Jews, among loyal, totally, as far as I know, but totally loyal to the regime. At this point, Hans Stengel realized that he might bring this up with Hitler. Next day, Mischke said, let's see. So no interview took place. It was abolished. Hitler was busy, he couldn't see him. There was the inevitable meeting.
Interesting.
And I wrote to him and said, well, this business about Jews being here in the country might be taken rather ill. Whereas my son had certain of his own friends, like Mr. Baruch and the like, who used to stay in New York. I don't know what he did with it. He may have excluded it or not.
Yes, that's an interesting
story. But I did write to him
story.
To North Africa, I think. He was, by this time, in Casablanca, mm-hmm. having pneumonia, I think, mm-hmm. or recovering from it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That was very so late-ish 40s,
right.
under Labour government.
Yes. Yes.
Sorry, this is just an anecdote.
Oh, it's wonderful. I want to get back to Washington 42-5.
Yeah.
And how you...
I can tell you what happened with that.
Tell me.
I was, I knew John Foster, who was a legal advisor and had been a fellow to my college. He was a very agreeable, remarkable, very odd man, not worth describing to you really, who, he was very free spirit, lacked certain human qualities, benevolent, amusing, so, not exactly an adventurer, but sort of full of vitality and fun. Couldn't understand why poetry was written, why words were put in this funny way together. He never read a novel in his life because he didn't want to read false statements about reality when he would read history and newspapers. And he couldn't imagine living in a world that didn't have telephones, for example. He didn't smoke, didn't drink. He went to bed with more ladies than anybody in the 20th century. Well, his promiscuity was total. He didn't know the meaning of the word love, I think. He was like a very nice dog, very frisky dog, when didn't happen to have a human soul. He had a heart,
yes.
a nervous system, and a very good quick brain,
yes.
and terribly benevolent. He was a pure metamite utilitarian.
Yes.
He believed in maximizing human pleasure.
Mm.
He was altruistic.
Yes.
But pleasure to him meant physical pleasure.
Yes.
Therefore, medicine, he was prepared to his back, because that minimized pain.
Yes.
But research, he was a fellow of all sorts. Research into, I don't know what, Crusaders and Malta seemed to him to be mad, absolutely. But since people enjoyed it, he didn't want to stop them. Because
yes.
pleasure was all right, and they took that pleasure in these funny ways. His natural friends were the rather sort of slightly dubious Jewish lawyers in Brooklyn, those sort of people.
Yeah. But he was legal advisor to the State Department?
To the British Embassy.
Or to the British Embassy?
No, he was English.
Sorry.
And he happened to be on the other side
yeah.
in the war, so
yeah.
he offered himself a job, didn't he? Yeah. Legal advisor, all right, he was first cousin of the head of Chancery or something. He went to Eton, but was expelled.
Yeah.
He was expelled for the...
And was it through him that you got seconded to?
No. No. The point was ultimately is, what happened was that I was going to Moscow, as I told you. For 2 years.
Yes.
Well, I stayed with him while I was in this limbo.
Right.
And then, and he was the man who kept inventing jobs for me, because he thought I mustn't go back and be killed by the Nazis. But then, when I got back to America, the job I had in New York had nothing to do with him.
Yeah.
But when I, at the end of my job in 41, it was he who thought that I might do this particular job, which I did do.
Yes.
And got into the job.
I see.
That he did.
Right.
And I don't know how to tell you about him. It's something to do with something.
He was a friend.
No, I'll tell you why. But he had a certain number. He had about 3,000 intimate American friends. He was the most popular Englishman that ever was in America. Because he was amusing, he was agreeable, he was gay, he was full of life. Adored Americans. Didn't like being with one or two people in the room. Liked being with 50. I once asked him at All Souls, when he was going to bed, whether what would keep him in the room. He said, well, if two or three people came in, I wouldn't, but if 30 people came in, I'd stay. So it was odd, you see.
Yeah.
He lacked certain human qualities, as you perceive.
Yeah.
And I mean, all these girls he used to go to bed with ugly girls, because He did them good. I mean, he didn't mind who he did it with.
Yeah.
And it set them up. Because
yeah.
nobody else would.
Yeah.
He did it purely as an act of kindness. This is my friend Sir John Foster. He became a Conservative MP.
Yeah.
And he became Under Secretary of the Ministry because of the Office of Commonwealth Relations. And he said, I do what I might. I couldn't get the work of the office last more than 12 hours a week.
Who yeah. else was in that team?
Well, he met the new various Social Americans
yeah.
and introduced me to them when I stayed with him. And then I had a friend called Rumbold, who yes. was the second secretary,
yeah.
who I'd known at Oxford. And they had certain old friends. Through them, I met other Americans. Mm-hmm. And through them, yet other Americans. And I began having, I became a member of a set. The set consisted of, to the exact numbers, but still, I've still kept up with them. Well, partly Felix Frankfurter, too, who I knew. There was, first of all, the left wing, Philip Graham, who was the law clerk to Frankfurter.
Yes.
His wife, Kay, now this
yes.
rather well-known lady,
yes.
Catherine. Then called Edward Pritchard. I don't think I've told you about
Yeah, you've it. Told me about him. Tennessee went to jail.
Kentucky.
Kentucky went to jail.
Went to jail. He was one of theirs. Various, Donald Hiss, brother of Alger Hiss. In the State Department.
John
Michael
Ferguson.
Ferguson. What?
John Ferguson.
John Ferguson, same thing. So you see the sort of,
yes.
there was one lot.
And they all lived in a house, didn't they?
Originally they lived in a house called, the, I forgot the name of the house. Yes, they did. But then when they married, they didn't.
Yeah.
But I mean, they did live in a house. And Johnny, what's his name, Oakes, who in times afterwards, he lived in a house.
Yes.
It was called Hockley.
Hockley.
And it was in Washington.
In Georgetown or in...
No, not Georgetown. It was called Hockley and one year I used to go and dine there. Oh. They were very good company.
Yeah.
It was very, very nice. And all New Dealers.
Yeah.
Which was my natural,
yeah.
So to speak, political climate.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, I found no difficulty talking to the tall. I found myself in total harmony.
But you sound as if you
were one lot.
You sound as if you were closer in harmony to American New Deal liberalism than you were to British socialism.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh, Lord, yes. But I was closer to American politics than I was to English politics.
Yes.
Because I judge things in tremendously personal terms, which is maybe an exaggeration. In England, politics were made by institutions, ministries of a regular kind. Groups of, let's say, conservatives met country houses. In other words, certain persons of a certain sort. These were groups and sets of people. Parties, the Labour Party, whatever it is, and groups in that. In America, everything was entirely personal. The State Department was institutional. The Treasury up to a point.
Mm-hmm. But the White
Nothing
House...
Nothing else was. Not only White House. If you asked any American in the war, what do? He said, I work for Mr. Nelson. I work for Henry Morgenthau. Not I work in the Treasury.
Yes.
State Department was the State Department. We didn't say I work for Mr. Hull. We didn't say that.
Yeah.
You see, they were really diplomats, I mean the regulars, they went on. The New Deal upheaved all the other departments.
Yeah.
We didn't say I work in the Department of Justice. I work for Mr. Biddle.
Yeah.
You see, that was a normal answer.
Yeah.
And relations, politics were to a large extent fashioned by relationships of with officials, but above all, as it were, ministers or council secretaries, some, with cabinet members,
mm-hmm.
to each other.
And it was
so it was in Oxford.
And it, yes, I see.
Between colleges and between dons. So I understood how that worked without difficulty.
Yes.
Yes. Much more like Oxford, like England.
Yes. And you didn't find America repulsively vulgar, coarse, crass.
I was very unhappy
things.
In New York, but I didn't know very many people. And I think I told you, I used to stand on the 44th floor of the Rockefeller building, looking at the street, and a sudden desire to commit suicide.
Mm.
Sudden desire to throw myself out.
Mm.
And I felt all these little ants running about. One more, one less, couldn't make a difference.
Yeah.
I felt somehow in the, we're just a cipher, a number.
Yeah.
Had no individual personality at all.
Yeah.
But in Washington, it's quite different.
Yeah.
No, I did not find it vulgar. No. Washington was not very vulgar either.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other towns would have been more. But I didn't mind it. No. The coarseness, vulgarity, no. The warmth
yes.
compensated for everything.
Yes.
For everything.
Yeah.
I didn't know many Jews, very few.
Mm-hmm.
My life was entirely spent among wasps, swallowing the.
Yes.
You see, now, my other lot of friends were the State Department Russian experts,
yeah.
who I must admit, through somebody, I can't remember, I think John Russell had served in Moscow, and I did made friends with me in the embassy. Mm. So Trip Boland, who was the famous,
yeah.
who became an intimate friend,
yeah.
and Menko and all the others, there was a man called Freddy Reinhardt, there was a man called Derbrow, George Kennan, after all, when I met Moscow afterwards, he still does part of the same world.
Yes.
You see? And I met, quite importantly, in Washington, parties were given by American, British, and there were hostesses in Washington who always asked people with diplomatic rank as such. In London, embassies don't count all that much.
Mm-hmm.
French ambassador, American ambassador, are all right, but it isn't tremendous sort of. I mean, feather in your cap to get the American ambassador to your table. But in Washington, ambassadors counted far more.
Yes.
There was a sort of
yes.
social tops,
yes.
at least all the important. But even the Brazilian ambassador
right.
was okay.
Right. Right.
Mm, see?
Yes.
And
you enjoyed that kind
yes,
of diplomatic.
Yes, I met people there.
Yes.
And through them, met others. And I had a very rich social life.
Mm-hmm.
I was invited out
yes.
by Americans, by Frenchmen, by Brazilians, by
yes.
Swedes, all kinds of things. I had a very agreeable, diplomatic, social life in a fascinating town where, of course, everything was put at the center of the world.
Yes.
And everything was going there. Anyone of importance came.
Did you have a sense immediately that
there were also 30 dons there from Oxford in various government departments.
Oh, really?
They formed the mafia.
Right.
When you wanted something done, with some other government department represented in Washington, you rang up somebody you knew quite well, and they told you everything.
Yeah.
There was an underground mafia of dons,
yeah.
who were members of these. There were 3,000 British officials in Washington
yeah.
during the war. That's
yeah.
all the number.
Yeah.
So I had a very good time, I feared. I was ashamed, that's all of the war.
Why ashamed?
Well, people were suffering and dying and having doing all kinds of things and being blitzed. Sleeping in sort of tubes, tube stations.
Yeah.
Here I was, the most, with excellent food, more money than I was ever given in Oxford.
Yes.
Far more, untaxed.
Yes.
Having
a wonderful
time. Having a wonderful time.
Yeah. What did you feel, I mean, as a...
And above all, very little work.
Really?
By nature, I'm idle. Writing these telegrams was not very hard work.
Yeah.
You had to read
Halifax
through.
Didn't work you very hard.
Halifax worked nobody very hard. Halifax had nothing to do with the embassy much. He was a viceroy by nature.
Mm.
He looked with contempt upon these pen pushers who came from Winchester and other inferior schools. And they answered in kind. They didn't like him.
Well, who did the work then?
Well, the worst pen pushers, there were all these workers. So William Hayter, I mean, Ronald Campbell, there were. All the diplomatic corps did work. But the point of my job was just producing this weekly telegram. All I had to do was to read the precis of the newspapers which were done in New York
mm-hmm.
by the propaganda office, anyway, for the information, go to the press club, have lunch with people, talk to people in the White House, like Pritchard, talk to people in the State Department who knew what I was doing,
mm-hmm.
and get a little hang of things,
yeah.
which if we live in Washington, would be very stupid not.
Yeah.
It wasn't a question of cocktail parties.
Yeah.
We never learned anything then. As a Christian in general,
working your network.
Well, you've read the Times, you knew very well that if Arthur Croc made an attack on the Navy Department, he was put up to it by the War Department.
Yes.
If you knew the basic relationships,
yes.
you see, the code was plain.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, it was a leaky town.
Yes.
I knew nothing about being sort of real secrets. I mean, I knew nothing about defense secrets
yes.
of the Army or Navy.
Yes.
That was about politics. was fairly open.
Yes. Did you travel much in the States?
Well, I was sent around the States to talk to British consuls in order to get the hang of the States. It's very enjoyable, quite useless. Mm-hmm. All that was, I was entertained by consuls who wanted to be praised by me for their help. And I always met the Americans at their tables were very pro them, that how marvelous they were.
So, that was useless.
I learned nothing, no. But I did go around.
Yes.
I went to the Middle West, well, the other thing is that I told you my story about the minority of the labor movement.
No, tell me.
Oh, that's something. When I was in New York, in The Propagandist, one of my assignments was, I told you, the non-smart elements of society, which meant Negroes, Jews, Catholics, Labour, Mormons, and generally speaking, persons on the wrong side of the tracks, non-WASP, whatever, after all, the establishment still to an enormous extent in water. The number of important Catholics is not great. I mean, there were some, but nothing like what happened afterwards. Well, the AFL was in alliance with the DUC, that was the word. They were well disposed, war effort. But the CIO, which was anti-AFL, well, not that so, they were, came from Catholic countries in Europe. Poor, they were unskilled workers, they came from Italy, Balkans, Central Europe. There was excuse the part. They were in bad terms, I say, with the AFL. They were, the church was violent isolationist. And so were they, therefore. Moreover, all the other empires had gone to pieces. There was no Russian empire, there was no Austro-Hungarian empire. Number of, there was a French empire, but number of French citizens in even Lebanese was not very great. British Empire.